Welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast, where two friends who watch a lot of horror movies together go out and watch a particular horror movie and try and decide what's wrong with it and what can be done to fix it. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And on this episode, we're going to be discussing the new release from New Line Cinema, The Nun. For those of you who don't know, it's part of the nascent Conjuring universe from the mind of James Wan. The basic premise of The Conjuring, and by extension, The Conjuring universe, is it follows these married paranormal investigators named Ed and Lorraine Warren, played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, respectively. By and large, these films are decent. The Conjuring's pretty good. Conjuring 2, less so. Annabelle is, to catch a phrase from my partner in crime, dog shit god-awful. But the prequel is sort of an unlikely critical darling, kind of in the vein of the prequel to Ouija, the original of which is one of the worst films I've ever seen of any kind. And the prequel to which is, again, pretty good. Would you agree with that assessment, Matt?
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I think there's been more and more of that lately. It's just the first one being rushed out the door as a proof of concept, and then the second one actually having a little bit of time and artistry put into it.
Anyway, so now that you have a little bit of grounding in the Conjuring universe, Matt's going to give you a synopsis of The Nun.
Right, so forget everything you've just heard, because The Nun has very little to do with any of it. This is the earliest, by some measure, Conjuring-adjacent movie set in the 1950s in Romania, so it's both spatially and temporally very divorced from all the other business that we've seen Ed and Lorraine Warren get up to. It is about a nun in training and a priest. These two rendezvous with a local boy in a town in rural Romania. Again, movie set in the 1950s, but they sort of almost, you know, step through a portal to the 1850s, because this place is a real backwater. I think that one of the things the movie has going for it is that kind of, you know, the first scene of a Dracula movie where you go to the inn and all the local yokels are telling you not to go up to that spooky castle on the hill.
Except we don't really see any locals other than this main guy.
Yeah, there's one halfway decent tavern scene, but it comes surprisingly late in the movie.
Yeah, it's a good hour plus in.
But yeah, they the three of them, the priest, the nun, and the other one, his name is Frenchie, French-Canadian gentleman, is established as sort of a lady killer. He flirts with the nun a lot. Let me get their names real quick. The nun is Sister Irene, priest is named Father Burke, and as mentioned, the yokel is named Frenchie. And the three of them go up to this cloistered abbey where there's been some paranormal ruckus of late. A nun has committed suicide under strange circumstances, hanged herself.
Yeah, and the film actually begins, in fact, with this aforementioned hanged nun going down into this very spooky, haunted hallway with an older nun who may or may not be the abbess or the mother superior. It's never really made clear.
It's a lot of very thick fog, like fog machine fog, or dry ice fog on the ground, swirling around their ankles.
Yeah,
it's very hokey in a way that I appreciated. I'm really not knocking it. I wish there'd been more of that, actually.
Yeah, and the Mother Superior opens this door that says in Latin that I'm not entirely sure is correct, God ends here, finit hic Deo. I don't think that's conjugated correctly, or rather declined correctly. You know, an old Latin nerd at heart. But anyway, it essentially means God ends here, and that's what they say it means, so that's the important thing. And the Mother Superior goes in with her lantern. Meanwhile, the younger nun is just sort of waiting there and praying in a very panicked fashion. And after about 15 seconds or so, she can no longer see the lantern light. And then shortly after that, a bloody hand sticks out. And at first we think it's the demon nun. It's actually the Mother Superior saying, like, yeah, go, run away, flee. You know, don't let it take you.
Yeah, you know what you have to do. Very
right.
Ambiguous missive that's only, you know, that's meant to be lost on the audience by design.
Yeah, you're not sure at first whether she's just supposed to, I don't know, run away and talk to the Vatican or something and get them to fix it. But as it's made clear very shortly after that, she is, you know, sacrificing herself so that the demon doesn't have a vessel with which to escape. And so she hangs herself.
So right off the bat, it's a very, the movie is set in a location that has a lot of possibility, I think. You know, it's set, you know, I like that it's that it's sort of a period piece. I wish that there was more of that. The actors are all pretty credible. Some of the dialogue is very hit or miss, but it's generally delivered pretty well.
So Damien Bashir plays the priest, Father Burke. He's done a lot of TV, and he's good. And then in kind of a weird quirk, the nun is played by Thaisa Farmiga, who is Vera Farmiga's younger sister, although they're like 24 years apart, so, you know, could plausibly play her daughter or a younger version of her. And Vera Farmiga is Lorraine Warren in the Conjuring films. So we expected a connection there, and I'll get into that later. But she's also good. She's been on several seasons of American Horror Story, which, despite being pretty hit or miss in general, has some good performances in it. And Frenchie is fine. You know, they don't give him a lot to do, but he's fine.
Yeah. So we're sort of front-loading the positives this time around, which is very out of character for us to the extent that we've established a brand. I guess on that note, there's a little bit of levity in the movie that actually lands, or landed for me at least. There was two gags that made me laugh, which I don't expect to see. I mean, you go into a horror movie like this that's gotten, you know, middling reviews at best, and sort of wonder if the scares are going to work. It never even occurs to you that it might also be funny. It, deliberately funny, I mean, not just haphazardly funny by mistake. But it's a perfectly diverting movie. It's got some spooks and some chuckles, and it all goes to shit steadily. This is where the positivity ends, basically.
It starts out with like a perfectly promising 15 to 20 minutes before they even head over to Romania. It bears brief mentioning with Father Burke, you know, is summoned to the Vatican, and
there's a powwow with a couple other cardinals,
one of whom is played by one of the leads from Kill List, which is one of the first horror movies Matt and I watched together.
Yeah. So I don't know the actor's name, actually. But
Michael Smiley?
Yes, how could I forget? Yes, no, he has a very distinctive face.
Yes.
And I liked that whole scene because it felt very much like it had been written like a spy thriller. Like, your mission should you choose to accept it. Yeah, that I like that backroom Vatican, like, Da Vinci Code nonsense. I don't know. There's a lot of frankly, in retrospect, kind of silly. There's a silly amount of mystery hanging over the whole enterprise, the whole mission he's sent on. Yeah. Like, it's not at all apparent why he was specifically picked. And then when he rendezvous with Sister Irene, she has no idea why she was picked either. And they never really get a definitive answer on that. They're just kind of thrown together because of the machinations of the plot. Really, the movie's really just in a hurry to get itself started.
Yeah. So Father Burke, who has also this kind of mysterious, dark past that has caused him to stop apparently working for the church in this sort of investigatory capacity, at least for the past several years. Maybe something happened during the war, I guess, because this is set in I believe we mentioned 1952, so not long after the Second World War. And this gets expanded on later, but at the beginning, it's just sort of not clear, you know, what his deal is. Just some bad shit happened to him.
Just sort of obligatory haunted priest character. I don't think there's a priest in a horror movie without a lot of psychological baggage or something that's gone wrong in their past.
Yeah, that's very true. Father Burke goes, meets up with Irene. They team up, they head out to Romania, and they meet Frenchie, who is apparently the one who discovered the body of the nun hanging from a rope outside the abbey when he was delivering food and supplies. So he takes them there, and before they go inside or try and meet with anyone, he takes them to the ice house, I think they call it, which apparently is just like a giant refrigerator, basically. And this is where he put the body of the hanged nun. And he comments on the fact that they find her in there basically propped up, like sitting up.
Yeah, like she's waiting at a bus stop or something.
And he points out that he definitely didn't leave her like that. So, you know, that's very, very spooky.
Yeah, that's sort of the first, well, I don't know. I didn't like that the way that scene played out. I think it would have been scarier to see him stow the body in the ice house and then go and get them, and then when they return, the body's been tampered with.
Yeah, rather than just us taking his word for it. I mean, there's no reason he'd be lying. But
no,
just,
I mean,
it's
yeah.
It's not like...
He's pretty on the level.
Like, oh, okay, well, I guess that was a spooky thing that happened that we didn't
see. It's a spooky thing that happened to him and no one else, including...
The audience.
The audience and the two other characters. There's, oh, that must have been very scary for you to experience. My condolences, I guess.
Which is the first of many misfires in this movie.
Yeah, there's a fair number. Although, I don't know. Let me talk kind of holistically for a minute here. My big abiding beef with the Conjuring franchise is that every movie after the first one, the first one also, actually, come to think of it. So every single movie in the franchise has taken time out of its runtime to test out, basically to audition monsters for future movies. The first scene of the first Conjuring is all to do with Annabelle, this haunted doll, who has now had two movies to call her own.
Yeah, and Conjuring 2 opens with the nuns audition, and then later...
It's got some Amityville stuff thrown in there, too. Like, they're kind of trying to revive that dead horse.
Yeah, and also later in The Conjuring 2, they invoke this creature called the Crooked Man, which is apparently the next spinoff.
Wait, that one is even more half-assed than most of the others, I think. So here's the problem for me, is that some of these monsters are pretty intriguing. I think that design-wise, the nun, I find the most off-putting. But, you know, it's a pretty scary-looking creature. But because the franchise is obsessed with always trotting out the next hot monster, you know, that's going to tune in next week, that kind of mentality, all of the monsters kind of end up being shapeshifters. You know, they can kind of just do whatever they want. I mean, there's not a lot of internal logic dictating what they are or are not capable of. The films are really seem designed on a scene-by-scene basis to just besiege you with whatever the filmmaker thinks would be scariest in any given moment.
Yeah.
So it really, I mean, James Wan's movies, I don't think I'm the first to describe them this way. They all feel sort of like haunted house rides in that, you know, you go from one room to the next and there's not really a consistent theming or not really a, you know, in one room you're being attacked by a vampire and then you round the corner and it's a zombie. And the movies aren't quite that slapdash, but you do walk out of it feeling like it was fun but kind of disposable, the way that your run-of-the-mill haunted house is. And I think that part of that is because they forfeit part of their identity it almost makes the movies and the monsters that are the main draw feel a little insecure, that they're constantly like putting on different masks, going like, is this scary? Is this scary? You know, there's, I don't, like, if your character is a Pennywise who is a shapeshifter and that's what it is and that's what's scary about it, that's fine. That is an identity. I don't know if that distinction makes any sense whatsoever. But when it's a creature who is established as the nun, and you know, that's what you pay money for, presumably, and then it's never actually a nun. It's always a demon disguised as a nun, or a demon disguised as the Crooked Man, or a demon possessing a porcelain doll named Annabelle. Even Annabelle 2, which was one of the better of these movies, there was a lot of business with a haunted scarecrow. You know, I don't know if you remember this, but there's surprisingly little Annabelle in Annabelle Creation. And at least for a good chunk of its runtime, there's not a lot of the nun in the nun. The nun, anyway. There's a couple other nuns that kind of come and go.
Yeah, and so I guess getting back to the synopsis, where we can talk about some of these other nuns,
yes.
I guess. After they find the body of the nun, having gotten up to wait for the bus of her own accord, Father Burke and Sister Irene and Frenchie at first head into the abbey. They encounter someone they believe to be the Mother Superior, the abbess. She's completely, it's impossible to see her face, completely impossible. There isn't even the vaguest hint, because she's wearing this black veil. And nobody seems to think that's fucking suspicious. I don't, you know.
No, she's just sitting there like a department store mannequin with the voice of like a Halloween witch, you know, like an evil crone in a cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, like welcome to the monastery. Yeah, that kind of, I mean, I'm making it sound a little bit more.
Yeah, it's not
nasally.
Quite that goofy, but yeah, that's more or less the deal.
She's just transparently evil in a way that's a little bit comical, and they are just very trusting.
Yeah, she's also hanging out down in the crypt.
Yes, yes. Like, stock still. We cannot overemphasize this. She does not budge an inch. The entire time they're having this conversation, doesn't scratch her nose,
yeah,
nothing.
She's hanging out in this crypt, because the abbey was originally a castle built by this duke, and there's more about that later. But so this crypt has a bunch of stone relief carvings of dead kings or dead, you know, nobles or whatever, over what are presumably their burial places. You know, very high fantasy almost. Sort of, this is where the royals are buried. This is where they bury the lords of the manor or whatever. And yeah, she's just hanging out down there, and nobody seems to think that's odd. They're a little bit spooked when they first realize she's there, but after that, they're just kind of talking to her and getting what they think is the lowdown. Anyway, she informs them that they can't speak to any of the nuns because they take a vow of silence overnight, sunset to sunrise, and it's almost sunset. So there are rooms they can stay in the abbey. And Frenchie's like, all right, well, I'm going to go back into town. And by the way, when they're on their way up, his horse refuses to go any farther. And
which is an old trope.
Which is a very old trope.
Which I was happy to see, but then they did it very, they just sort of phoned it in, I think.
Yeah, it was not super enthusiastic, but at the same time, it was just like, nobody wants to listen to the fucking horse, ever. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, animals know shit. Anyway, so Frenchie heads out, and of course, in the intervening 2 minutes between when they're in the crypt and when he's outside, it has gone from afternoon to pitch black.
Right.
And he's trying to find his way out to his cart, and he spots someone that looks like the dead nun, like she looks to us in the beginning of the movie before she's killed herself. And he does the obvious thing of, who's there? Where are you going? And then starts chasing after her, as opposed to minding his own goddamn business and getting the hell out of there. And, you know, they play peekaboo throughout this sort of haunted foresty area where there are also like grave markers. And finally, she appears behind him. He turns around. She's gone, which is like the signature scare of the Conjuring universe.
Mm-hmm.
It is done to death in every one of the movies in the series, and this one is no exception. A body just kind of drops from a tree, falls on him, and then she's zombie nun for some reason, which is a really weird decision, I thought. Like, I don't know why suddenly we just have zombies in this Conjuring movie. Matt's right in that all these movies are very much a, you know, throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, but they've never gone the zombie route.
Well,
to my recollection.
I mean, it's hard to say what it is, because, you know, one minute it looks, as you said, she looked perfectly put together. The next minute she's a shambling corpse. So it can't, if it's the same entity, then it's not just a zombie. It's like some entity, again, trying a bunch of, you know, it's like a juggler trying to keep a lot of shit in the air, hoping that you'll be wowed just by its versatility alone. You know, one second it's one thing, and then the next it's another. And I guess that kind of air of unpredictability could be scary, but I don't know. I was especially five Conjuring movies deep. I'm really starved for just a little bit of consistency. But this is sort of and it's strange because, you know, I mean, James Wan has like a bit more of a hands-off role now. I mean, he didn't direct this movie. It didn't, you know, wasn't...
or either of the
Annabelle's. Yeah, he's just directed both Conjurings, but he's kind of set the tone and established the template for all of these movies to follow. I was reminded at points watching this when it seemed like it had a lot of potential and then kind of pulled the same tricks out of the hat that all the other Conjuring movies have and kind of went back to that well and squandered its potential. I was reminded a little bit of how Wonder Woman kind of shits the bed, like right near the end, where it like gets real Zack Snyder-y real fast. Like,
yeah,
there was some kind of directive from on high that said this has to be stylistically similar enough to Batman v Superman to it can't completely, we're not quite ready to let that baby bird leave the nest. One of the consistencies, I guess, across all of these movies is that when you get right down to it, so I said before that I find the nun pretty scary looking, and I do. In the prologue of this movie, I found her quite frightening when she's just slowly drifting towards the camera, not budging, in a very slow, methodical, otherworldly kind of way. But really, when you get right down to it, all of the demons in all of the Conjuring movies love nothing more than wrestling. They just when you get up close and personal with them, they just want to throw down. They'll start. It's like it like turns into a cage match. Every single movie does this eventually. It's in the Insidious movies too. You know, once you go toe-to-toe with one of these monsters, they'll start throwing you across the room and yelling in your face, and in the case of the nun, speaking English, which was ill-advised.
We'll get back around to that, I think. But yeah, it definitely every... I think just about every James Wan movie, really, there's just demons want to wrestle.
Yeah.
And doesn't really work. It's not, you know, obviously people being hurled around by supernatural forces is not unique to the James Wan extended universe, but it's really like the only thing that happens with the demons in these movies.
Yeah, I mean, once they get their hands on you, it's like it stops being a horror movie and turns more into, like, I don't even know what to compare it to, like Constantine, maybe? I'm trying to think of, because it's not quite, it doesn't quite turn into an action movie, but you know, the way that like Constantine isn't really a horror movie, but also isn't really an action movie.
Right.
That kind of, it's just
sort of in the middle.
Yeah. Right. Very much like that. And then it's also kind of has action movie sensibilities, in that the demons are pretty much always trounced by the good guys, and there's always a fairly uplifting ending where the nefarious powers have been vanquished by the enduring power of love or whatever,
yeah.
Or faith.
Anyway, Frenchie manages to get away because every time it looks like something bad is going to happen to anyone really in a Conjuring movie, it doesn't.
Yeah, they're very timid, these movies. They really, once you get to like a character, you know that they're pretty much untouchable.
Yeah. So he shuffles backward into a cluster of grave marker crosses, and this is one of the sight gags that we were talking about. He pulls one out of the ground and just sort of wields it like any priest would hold a small cross in his hand to fight a demon. He's just carrying...
He's just smuggling a man-sized cross back to town in order to ward off evil spirits.
Almost Christ-like, but you know, in a gag sort of way. And he just sort of runs off. And then Sister Irene and Father Burke are in their quarters. Sister Irene sort of asks Father Burke about his past. And he opens up about this young boy in France during the war who he concluded was possessed. And he later appears to regret that conclusion, although that it's not clear why, because it seems pretty clear in the flashback that there's something supernatural.
Yeah, there's
going
some
on.
Demonic fuckery at work. I mean, it's pretty apparent.
So he conducts an exorcism. And kid gets hurt and he dies from his wounds. And that's why, I guess, Father Burke is haunted and why he's kind of strayed from being the miracle hunter, quote-unquote, that the Vatican sends around looking into things like this. The two of them go to bed, and then Father Burke is awakened by the radio playing the same song that was playing earlier after having been turned off.
It's one of the, like, two or three songs that's in every movie set in the 40s or 50s. It's either that or
this one is You Belong to Me, which is supposed to be, I guess, vaguely
it's always You Belong to Me or We'll Meet Again by Vera Lynn. You know, that's always it's always those two fucking songs
yeah.
let you know that it's a World War II era movie or shortly thereafter.
Yeah. He sees this small figure running around and chases after it. This kid, Daniel, that he exorcised to death. Daniel, or the specter of Daniel, vomits up this snake.
A big snake, too.
Big,
it looked like a boa constrictor, almost.
Big goddamn snake, which pounces on Father Burke. Father Burke throws it away, but he kind of, like, trips and falls back into this open grave. And then It pans up to this stone cross on which is carved, Here Lies Father Burke, which is like a very sort of campy, sort of creep
it's
show
like a
twist.
It's like Looney Tunes almost. Like, but yeah, no, it looked like the last panel of like an EC horror comic. No, yeah, the creep show comparison is very apt.
And the coffin slams shut over him, and then when it cuts to a wide shot from the side of the grave, it is completely covered over. So he's suddenly buried. But thankfully, and this is preloaded, because earlier they spot these bells that are posted next to some people's graves, and they explain, like, oh, well, during the Middle Ages, people would get buried alive occasionally, and so, or they were afraid of being buried alive. So they'd have these bells with strings that went down to the ground. So if you were buried alive and you woke up and you needed to get out, you could tug on the string and ring the bell, and hopefully someone would come and dig you up before you died. And so Father Burke does that very thing.
This is just, you know, just another example of the scares in this movie having no internal rhyme or reason. So it's hard to say what's really going on from one moment to the next, and not in a way that feels especially surreal or dreamlike. It's just, as Jim said earlier, throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah. Sister Irene wakes up, uses her vision sense, I guess,
Did we even touch on that? I don't think we've mentioned. Sister Irene from childhood has had visions or hallucinations, what have you.
Yeah, which I guess is how she was kind of brought into the church in the first place. So she, this is the first time we see her visions really like manifesting. But again, not like a vision. It's like a superpower, really, where she just kind of like hears a faraway noise and focuses on it. She can hear it clearly, and she follows it out. And even before she has any like real reason to suspect that, hey, this is Father Burke, she starts just shouting, "Father!" And you know, tearing off toward the noise. The demon makes a bunch of other bells ring to confuse her, but again, she uses her spidey sense to figure out which bell is the one
she wants.
Silences all the other bells and starts digging. And by the way, for a girl that probably only weighs about 100 pounds, she digs him out super quick.
She does, and there just happens to be a shovel lying next to the tree. I guess, you know, the demon overlooked that.
Or the demon was trying to be sporting. Like, I don't really know. Yeah.
Well played. You solved my riddle.
There's more that lends credence to that than just the shovel, and I'm going to get that in a second. So she gets Father Burke out just in time because he's being, like, attacked by hands inside the coffin.
Yeah. You know what it is? He's being attacked by hands. Yes, that's true. That's accurate. He's being jump-scared.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple shots. It cuts between her digging to him in the coffin with a little lighter held up next to his face. It's like ripped straight from the end of The Vanishing. Spoilers. And turning that into kind of a catchphrase. Sorry, everyone. You know that he's going to get jump scared, or that you in the audience are going to get jump scared, but you don't know exactly how it's going to manifest. Every jump scare in this movie, and this is kind of a James Wan thing, sort of his authorial signature, is that all the jump scares want to fake you out, make you think that it's going to come from one direction, and then it's going to it in fact comes from another direction entirely.
To the point where it would be surprised if it came from exactly the first direction.
Yeah, and in this movie is more afflicted by that than any of the others, maybe just because it's the fifth one. But the bit in the coffin, perfect example. The scene is designed to make you think that something is going to come out of the shadows by his feet, but then instead a bunch of hands erupt out of nothingness right by his face and start, like, you know, grabbing at him. So yeah, he happens to be attacked by hands, but there's just something that's so fucking arbitrary about it, about all the jump scares in this movie. Anything could have happened. Like, it could have been a tentacle, it could have been, you know, I don't know, a boy vomiting snakes. There wasn't a boy vomiting snakes in the trailer. You know, you don't advertise a movie called The Nun with a boy vomiting snakes, but the snake vomiting boy will probably get his own fucking movie now just because he tested well, you know, or The Nun made money. Therefore, Monster B is going to get his own spin-off series, sub-series. I don't know. It's all very played out.
Yeah. So she breaks him out and then finds out that underneath him are a bunch of books. Which weren't there when he was in the coffin, but that, of course, doesn't matter.
It looked like there was desiccated remains.
Yeah, there was a body in the coffin, too,
which was also not there mere moments ago.
Then they just automatically conclude, maybe the answers we seek are in these books, which...
is that what you meant by the demon being sporting? Like, literally giving them the, like, tools to combat it? Yeah, that was awfully odd.
Yeah. To the point where I just sort of looked at Matt and started laughing in the theater.
Uh-huh.
So they get out and they go back to the Abbey, and it's cloistered, so only Irene can go inside. She meets some of the other nuns, and they're praying. They trade off. It's something called perpetual adoration. Basically, some nun or other has been praying at all times, apparently for centuries, and I guess that helps keep evil at bay.
It's a lot of pressure.
That's right.
Kept thinking, like, Jesus, it would suck to be the one who messed it up.
Yeah, and every passing year makes that more stressful.
Yes.
Only one of the nuns really seems that inclined to talk to her. She explains the history of the Abbey. Apparently it was built by this duke who was into witchcraft, like every scary place ever. And I guess he summoned a demon.
Yeah, he opened a portal to hell.
He opened a portal to hell, and so there's a flashback of, you know, this demon like coming up out of the ground, like fissure in the ground. But just at that moment, the church came in.
A bunch of crusaders.
A bunch of crusaders, you know, with swords and crosses and, you know, all the accoutrements. And they slap him in chains, and they use this artifact that is supposed to contain the blood of Christ and not any sort of metaphorical...
It's not a church wafer. Yeah, it's actually...
It's not the sacramental wine. It's not in the Eucharist sense. It's in the literal, like, this is a relic. These are the bones of Jesus. This is the blood of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It's inside this tiny glass hollow cross, which in turn is inside. Like, it looks like a Christmas ornament, really.
It is, because it's like a little glass bauble that kind of looks like it could be, yeah, dangling from a limb of a pine.
They sprinkle this blood on the demon and on the fissure, and the demon gets sort of immediately dragged back down and it gets sealed up. But then I guess they just thought, okay, well, this place where there was a literal portal to hell, it's a good place for nuns to be.
Well, they're trying to... I mean, it makes a degree of sense because they're trying to keep the evil at bay. I got the impression that the portal has been sealed, but... It needs to be maintained.
Well, it clearly couldn't have been sealed that well, because apparently that worked for hundreds of years, but then bombing during World War II just happened to crack open the portal. Like hell is supposed to be literally underneath our feet.
It's right. Like,
if that were the case, then why did this Duke need all these convoluted witchcraft rituals?
Well, I guess he didn't have heavy munitions at his disposal. I guess a lot of gunpowder might have done the trick.
You know, you put in enough effort, you just go at it with a pick, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, so apparently bombing from, I don't know, the Germans or whatever opened the fissure back up.
Yeah. I mean, that didn't bother me conceptually. It was weirdly, that idea was introduced very flippantly in a way that I thought was kind of difficult to take seriously. But you know, I, again, I could buy the idea that they need to maintain some kind of vigil, and it's taking actual spiritual effort to keep these demons at bay, and maybe, you know, this one errant bombing run in rural Romania disrupted that process somehow. But the idea of a bomb just breaking open the ground and then
opening up the portal,
hell is under there, is... It ought to be a little bit more nuanced than that. I agree.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Father Burke is over in the crypt area where they spotted the abbess earlier, and he's reading these books that they got out of the coffin he was stuck in, and he identifies the demon as Valak, the Marquis of Snakes.
Well, he gets two cool names first. It's Valak the Defiler, Valak the Profane, Valak, the Marquis of Snakes. First of all, you're just expecting it to be another adjective. You know, it's such a funny moment because it respects the rule of three, you know? Or Defiler, Profane, Marquis of Snakes. It's like...
You know, the Earl of Lizards.
Yeah, the Duke of Salamanders.
The Baronet of Dragons.
Yeah, right. The patron saint of Gila monsters. It would have only been slightly more absurd if it had been Valak the Defiler, Valak the Profane, Valak regional manager of the Home Depot and, you know, Muskegon. That's, you know, it's like, it's so specific. And so, and I get, you know, the boy spits snakes at the guy, so that makes sense. But it's just
still goofy as all.
The lore in this movie is just, they're just so clearly making it up as they go along, and that applies to a lot of James Wan's work. It's kind of what prevents me from getting into his stuff. I don't know. In theory, so here's a question I have, again on more of a macro scale. It's hard for me to gauge where this would-be expanded universe thinks it's going. Because obviously the Marvel movies from day one were about assembling the Avengers and getting them all on screen in one place. You know, we can, RIP, we'll never know what the Dark Universe was going to become. But presumably that was their MO as well, was some League of Extraordinary Gentlemen bullshit. Where they were going to get them all on the same team. Something like that. Here, it's hard to imagine anything like that ever happening. So they're just a bunch of movies that are tenuously connected. And they do have connective tissue, but it tends to, I find, mar each individual movie rather than helping it. Like, there's a little bit of very weird fan service in this movie in particular that I'm going to hold off on getting into for the time being. But, I don't know what this is all building to. I suspect that all is, it isn't building to anything, that it's just kind of, and I think that contributes to my feeling when I'm watching these movies, that I'm just killing time. You know, there's like just a little bit more of my finite time on this earth that I won't get back. Even if it's a movie that I more or less enjoyed, it's not a building block in something bigger than itself. It's just sort of one damn thing after another.
After Burke identifies the Earl of Sandwich, he starts talking to what he believes is the Abbess again, and she stops talking at one point, head slumps down, there's like a crack.
Very sharp crack.
So she's dead, if indeed she were ever alive. Turns out she was not.
Yes. Because she then jump scares him and her arm falls off.
And nothing really comes of that. He just kind of, oh, damn. And it's all the same demon network that's been attacking all of them from day one, minute one. Anyway, it cuts to Frenchie, and this is probably my favorite shot in the whole film.
Oh, yeah, without question.
It's one of the two sight gags that works. It's just a wide shot of Frenchie sidled up to a bar with the giant cross like propped up in another chair.
Mm-hmm.
Like not as though
like
it's
they're,
sitting
like
there,
they're drinking buddies,
it's
almost.
And yeah, he's talking to the bartender. Apparently some 12-year-old girl hanged herself, and Frenchie gets a light bulb. He's like, wait, hanged herself? Must be connected.
Well, and then the guy running the tavern rattles off a bunch of other so-and-so went mad, and so-and-so lost his sight, and so-and-so's, you know, pigs turned inside out, or something like that. It's not an actual example. I wish that it was. But, you know, the idea is that some kind of curse is leaking out of the convent and proliferating in this small town. And I love the trope of the folksy, superstitious peasant people who actually know what's up. You know, hanging garlic in the windows and stuff like that. There's nowhere near enough of that in this movie. The period setting occasionally does it some favors, for me at least, like in the aforementioned scene where Frenchie is mucking around in the cemetery in the woods at night. He's waving a lantern in front of him, and that just, you know, tickles me. It's just more charming with a gas lantern for some reason, rather than him holding out a cell phone.
Yeah, no,
or something like that. I mean, I'm not trying to be like a Luddite. I'm a horror movie junkie, and there's a rich history of classic horror that I don't know. It just makes me feel all cozy. It's just kind of a blast from the past in a way that I like.
Frenchie, motivated by his ethics and, you know, perhaps by his nether regions, because as we've discussed, he's into Irene.
And that's kind of his, like, one defining characteristic, is that he's a sort of a horn dog. You know, it's very much, we don't actually see any evidence of that. It's very much a tell, don't show kind of thing with Frenchie. Like, it's constantly alluded to, but he never actually makes good on it, which I think is a missed opportunity.
It is. But he sallies forth to go save the two ecclesiastical folk. and meanwhile, Irene is walking through the halls of the Abbey, looking around for clues or something.
Right.
I can't seem to find any of the nuns. They all seem to have vanished. And then in one hallway, we see the big scare from the trailer that everybody saw, which is she's walking down a hallway, and then this apparently empty habit is like floating behind her. Just an empty black hole where the face
like an invisible nun.
Yeah, that's, an invisible nun.
Yeah.
The nun shape whispers to her like, "Sister, this way." And Irene turns to look, sees this this empty habit, and then there is the loudest scare chord of all time, and she gets attacked from the side corridor that's perpendicular to the screen.
Again, the jump doesn't come from the direction you're led to believe it will, which is as old as the hills at this point.
Yeah. And in the trailer, you're led to believe by this that she's getting attacked by Valak. And I mean, to a certain extent, every evil thing in this movie is...
Remind me again who Valak is. Defiler,
the profane, and Marquis of Snakes.
The Marquis of Snakes, thank you.
Yes.
That was on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah. You're led to believe that it's Valak in nun form, because it's a nun. But instead, in the movie itself, it's just another empty habit. It's just another invisible nun, no face thing. It's like, why wasn't she just attacked by the first one then? What's the point?
Yeah, it's not really much of a fake out. It's weird because in any given moment, especially where her character is concerned, you don't know, you quite literally don't know exactly what's going on, because she could be having a vision. You know, this could all just be some hallucination. It could be a dream. It could be Valak. It could be the nun of the nun. You know, the one on the poster, the one from Conjuring 2, which is the movie that established this side boogeyman. It could be, you know, maybe the nun can just be in more than one place at once. Why not? Because the rules are, as I'm really belaboring this point, but the rules are not set in stone.
No.
All of the monsters are just terribly elastic, in a way that I just don't care for that. It makes these movies just kind of slip through your fingers, you know? You can't get a grip on them.
The other dumb thing about this jump scare is that, again, she wrestles. Irene wrestles for a second, but mm-hmm. then it just lets her go. It's not even that she, like, fights it off. It literally just looks like it stopped fighting and, like, takes a step back.
Yeah, because it's a jump scare demon, Jim. It just exists to scare you, not actually hurt you. Which is kind of this movie's whole problem, is that once the scare chord is over, there's just nothing there. You know, then you're just biding your time waiting for the next one. And I'm going to go on the record. I don't mind jump scares on paper. I understand what they're, like, you know, loud, obnoxiously loud jump scares, especially in a movie theater, are grating to me only when they feel unwarranted, because I think that what a jump scare is meant to achieve is it's supposed to make you jump, obviously. It's kind of, you know, horror 101 here, but it's supposed to make your kind of heart leap into the back of your throat as if you were in the movie actually in peril. You know, it's supposed to give you a physiological reaction that creates an empathetic bond with the character on screen, because you're literally experiencing what they're experiencing. It's kind of like a monkey see, monkey do thing. It's just trying to shock you into dissolving that barrier between film and filmgoer. And that's all well and good, but they're used so... I already said flippantly. Oh, they're used so flippantly that it cheapens it. You know, I think a movie should have at most like three really memorable jump scares in it. If that's your only mode, then all of them are pretty much guaranteed to not make an impact, especially when they're all designed the same way, as we've already complained about with the fake outs, where, you go right and the movie goes left, that kind of thing. That only worked for me once in James Wan's whole career, which is the clapping scene from the first Conjuring, the when you think it's going to come from the basement, and instead it happens right next to her head. That's I think the last time that worked, and that was 2013.
5 years ago.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so Irene gets away because the demon doesn't really try that hard. She runs into all of the nuns who are all trying to pray to fend off the evil.
And that scene could have been fucking awesome. It turns into, I almost thought it was going to become like the Saving Private Ryan of praying scenes, because these nuns get fucked up. They're all praying in a circle in this church, and they're just getting thrown around and then like crawling back, and like they're bruised and bloodied but still praying. It's really kind of takes that idea of being, you know, like a warrior of God to very literally, like they're incurring battle damage in a way that I thought was actually kind of cool, but they don't push it that as far as I would have liked. Well, like if you're getting excited by what I'm describing, then
don't be
because that's not really how it goes.
No. Irene gets sort of supernaturally lashed with a pentagram on her back over the course of 5 strokes or whatever it takes. Obviously gets her habit torn off of her back. But finally, she hears Father Burke and Frenchie trying to get inside, and she unbars the door. And when they get in, she's like, yeah, the nuns and I are just in here praying. And they're like, what nuns, basically? And it turns out that she was alone the whole time, I guess, having one of her many visions.
Yeah, we know this because Father Burke just goes, visions. Right? Am I making this up?
No, I think you're right. I had forgotten that.
And it's not like a laugh out loud funny moment, because he's a perfectly capable actor. And he actually gets away with saying a lot of pretty goofy shit in this movie that another actor might not have been able to sell. That line is just one example.
Yeah. At one point, Frenchie saves them with a shotgun because the corpse of the some nun or other is like shrouded in there, and it gets up and another zombie nun, you know, attacks them.
Yeah, and that one pretty much is a zombie because it's killed with, you know,
with a shotgun. The quintessential anti-zombie weapon.
Uh-huh.
So then they decide, okay, well, the only way to fix all this is to reseal the portal to hell with the blood ornament.
Yeah. And Irene and Burke both learn of the portal separately from 2 separate exposition dumps. Burke from reading the ancient tome in which we learn the true name of Valak,
Marquis of Snakes.
The Marquis of Snakes, Baron of Geckos. And then she learns it from a nun who's confiding in her. Which turns out
not to be alive.
Well, yeah, because I just, again, vision. so there's those probably could have been collapsed into one scene. We don't really need to hear that stuff twice. The movie doesn't feel really redundant because it's being delivered in 2 different mediums. You know, one from a book, one from a human. You know, what we take to be a human. But it's still that there's, we're kind of a little over it at that point. So then when they say like, oh, we have to go seal the portal, it's like, yeah, I know, we're way ahead of you, because we've heard it twice, whereas they individually have just heard it once each.
Yeah. And apparently there's this very ornate looking key that, by the way, they had found on the suicide nun's corpse. And which I believe, like, throughout the movie up to this point, to have just been the key that unlocks the door that says God ends here. But as it turns out, it's the key to this, like, hidden rock cabinet where they keep
there's this really baby's first Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of scene where they look at a... It's a little Dan Brown, too, because they look at, like, a statue, and the statue is pointing to a wall, and then they go to the wall, and there's a little crack that happens to be a keyhole in disguise. It's just a very... They do, like, a little bit of Indiana Jonesing, but just in the laziest possible way, and only for about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
It's... I could have done without that.
Yeah.
Or with... I could have done with a lot more of it, too. But the amount that's in there now is just sort of weird and incongruous. Actually, a little bit more of Indiana Jones flavor might have been cool, just because the artifact with Christ's blood in it, apart from looking like a Christmas ornament, is, you know, a perfectly valid MacGuffin, but it feels more like something from Last Crusade rather than, you know, from whatever this movie's trying to be.
Right. When they take the bauble out of the rock cabinet and, you know, they explain to Frenchie that it's got the blood of Christ in it, he says, "Holy shit," which is, you know, like the most obvious gag they could have had. Yeah,
very Mel Brooksy. And right. then they just drive it into the ground, because Burke turns to him and says, "Yes, the holiest."
It's like it's not Christ's dung. You know, it's his blood.
Right. Like, it could have there was probably a take where he was like, "Yes, the holiest of shits." And just so that everyone, you know, some guy in the back of the theater was like, "Oh, ah, I get it."
The holiest.
Weird.
But if it had been somebody else, again, delivering it, other than Demian Bashir, who sells most things in that movie, it would have been uproariously laugh-out-loud funny, like it was just now.
Instead, it's just kind of befuddling.
I still chuckled because it was just so absurd, but he somehow gets within like a hair's breadth of kind of selling it, which again is to his credit. So it's now that they've figured out, like, okay, well, Sister Victoria didn't just commit suicide, she sacrificed herself so that Valak couldn't get out. So
right, because he has to possess a human, apparently.
Right. So
in order to make good his escape.
So they're going to go seal up the rift using this blood, like the Crusaders did the first time around. And they get separated. And when Valak finds his way back to Irene, she has been possessed, starts talking some shit to Frenchie, just like insulting him.
Just smack talking him in a pitched down voice.
Yeah, it's very, very like Z-list Pazuzu.
Yeah, but it's so nondescript. You know, it's something like, "Ah, oh, you could have saved them," or something, or like, "You're a fuck up."
The village is missing its idiot. You know,
it's yeah.
That's actually a line. I'm not just riffing.
Oh my god, really?
Yes.
It's like, why didn't Valak should have said that his mother dresses him funny? You know, that's. God, that's awful. So it's not exactly "your mother sucks cocks in hell, Karis, you faithless slime," is what we're trying to say. Like, if you're going to put words in Satan's mouth, they've really got to be cutting. You know, not like an inept roast.
Yeah. So Frenchie, who apparently is the one holding the blood bauble, hurls some of Christ's blood on her face, and that knocks Valak loose. Irene is free. Valak comes out, starts holding Frenchie up above its head, strangling him, and it kind of looks like she breaks his windpipe and hurls him to the ground dead. As it turns out, he's totally not dead, because these movies never kill anyone. Meanwhile, Irene gets hurled into this flooded chamber where Daniel, or the specter of Daniel, the possessed boy, with his snakes, he tries to drown her, and then Valak is trying to drown her, and meanwhile, Burke finds his way in, and he, you know, sallies forth with his cross, trying to do the standard, you know, "the power of Christ compels you, I banish you with the power of the Lord," etc. It's all a very rote sort of final confrontation. Eventually, Valak is drowning Irene, holding her under the water, and then inexplicably, like, lifts her out of the water when she's not quite dead, and she spits the blood of Christ onto it. Apparently, she, like, put the blood in her mouth for safekeeping,
uh-huh.
And it spits it onto Valak's face. And that's what defeats Valak.
Which is almost clever, because there was some foreshadowing in the first act where Frenchie is talking about how the local villagers will spit to ward off evil spirits, you know, and how he's above such things himself. And then when their backs are turned, he spits on the ground because they're coming up on the convent and he's creeped out. So this idea of spitting to keep the devil at bay is established. And it's not the sort of thing that you expect to be an obvious, like, Chekhov's gun. It's just a little bit of funny banter that has already had its payoff in the form of Frenchie spitting on the ground when no one is looking. So you're not expecting it to come back. That is conceptually cool, but the actual shot of her spitting Christ's blood is
very silly.
Stupid. She's spitting it right at the camera. First of all, it's like a demon's eye view. It's like Tessa Farmiga is spitting on your face, which is, I don't know, maybe some people are into that.
Yeah,
not this cowboy.
And that's pretty much it. You know, Burke was like bit on the eye by one of these demon snakes, so he's blind in one eye now.
Yeah, he spends the whole climax tussling with his own private demon who has just nothing whatsoever to do with anything else. And I get that it is literally his own demon, in that it's something that is it's a stain on his conscience, you know, it's something from his past that he's still wrestling with. That's fine, but he doesn't really get closure. Like, the demon boy is just vanquished when Valak is vanquished, so I guess they're the same entity, and Valak can just manifest itself in several ways in multiple places. It's so fucking wishy-washy, you know. Why not just have a third one show up? Then it would be an even match, you know. Why have it be 3-on-2 if Valak can be two entities at once? Why not 10? It's just fucking preposterous. I'm getting angry as I pontificate.
But that's pretty much it. Irene bandages over Burke's eye, and they climb into Frenchie's cart, and that's when it's revealed through a shot of the back of his neck, where there's like an upside down cross scar that apparently he's been somehow partly possessed, yeah, or brought under the sway of Valak. And flash forward 20 some years, and it's the scene at the beginning of The Conjuring.
The first Conjuring, where, or seen very near the beginning, in any case.
Where Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson are talking about this tomato farmer by the name of Maurice, whatever the hell his name is. It's Frenchie. Who's just possessed, and I guess contact with this guy is what gave Vera Farmiga her visions of Valak, and that's how it all ties back in. But again, it's just so lazy and limp-wristed.
It's the silliest fan service imaginable. I mean, it accounts for a lot of weirdness, like what is this French-Canadian dude doing in bumfuck nowhere Romania in the 50s? And then he, you know, moves back home just in time to be exorcised by the protagonists of the mainline Conjuring movies. But yeah, there's like, you know, he's obviously a throwaway character. He's a non-character. He's just part of a slideshow in the first Conjuring movie. And we know that his name is Maurice. He's a melon farmer in, like, Quebec or something like that. And all of that information has to be shoehorned into this basically completely unrelated, likable Romanian dude named Frenchie in this movie. At the very end, Tessa Farmiga has to go, "What's your real name?" And he says, "Maurice." And then he says, "Oh, my father was a melon farmer. Maybe I'll go do that for a living." So it all just gets... It did everything short of an old, like, vaudeville crook coming on screen to yank him off, you know? And just completely... really weird. A lot of prequels have this problem where they explain shit that... They answer questions that no one was asking. Like, who was Boba Fett's dad? You know, but this is even less. Literally no one cared about Maurice the melon farmer. You know, no one expected that to go anywhere. And in fact, it's what makes it really peculiar is that you know, Thaisa Farmiga looks very much like Vera Farmiga, and now there's just two lookalikes bumping around inside this already very unwieldy franchise, who have no connection with each other whatsoever genetically, as far as we're aware, unless they're saving that bombshell for a future installment. I'm getting tongue-tied.
Anyway, now that we've finally forced our way through the plot synopsis of this film, we'll take a break and we'll come back and try and talk about anything else about the movie we didn't like, and then try to patch together a prognosis. We'll be back in a moment.
I had a series of visions when I was younger. And after each one ended, the same thought would be stuck in my head.
What did you see?
I saw a nun.
Hey guys, Jim here during the break to let you in on some ways you can help support our podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Got an idea for the next movie you'd like us to fix? Feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
What?
She made him down. Callahan's here.
And we're back. So, Matt, what do you think could have been done to improve this movie besides not committing all the mistakes that we've talked about so far?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's my biggest piece of feedback, and I feel I've already drilled this into your heads sufficiently. But I think really just fix your monster, know what its parameters are, even if, you know, you don't need a character to give us some kind of exposition dump telling us what the nun can do and what the nun cannot do. But if you know when you're hunkered down at your desk writing the screenplay, then it will just come across. You know, in Alien, say, great movie, not a fair comparison, it's not at all apparent to the audience on a first viewing what the alien is capable of. It turns out it does all kinds of wacky stuff that no one could have seen coming going into that movie blind. But in retrospect, it all proceeds according to a certain logic that was known to the screenwriters. There's no kind of backwards engineering you can do on the nun to figure out where its powers end. Like it's just like a genie, basically. You know, it can do more or less whatever it wants, and that's just no good at all.
Which reminds me of the deal at the beginning when the Mother Superior, or whoever that old nun was, tells Sister Victoria, I think her name is. We never dropped that, but I think the nun who committed suicide, her name was Sister Victoria, tells her to go do what she has to do and not let herself get claimed by Valak, because Valak needs a vessel to escape. Why didn't Valak just take the Mother Superior? Clearly, she didn't have the opportunity to kill herself. Valak just killed her himself. So, yeah, he could have just possessed the Mother Superior, and then we wouldn't have had a movie. Like, you know, they're, I don't know.
At one point, one of the other nuns, who's actually just a hallucination or a vision, says, Valak disguises itself as a nun in order to move undetected. It's like, yeah, it's not working. You're the nun that's 7.5 feet tall and looks like a corpse with razor sharp teeth. You know, it's a for effort, but you're not exactly blending in. That was a very strange, again, I don't know why it couldn't just be a nun. Why does it always have to be a demon every single time? Like Annabelle is actually just a porcelain doll with some kind of demonic attachment, you know, but the all of the evil is coming from something satanic. You know, I'm so sick of that. You know, I miss the good old days where, you know, in Child's Play, it's just a serial killer in a doll's body, that it's so much simpler. It's so much easier to pitch that rather than opening portals
and this demon that can be anything.
And this demon that can be anything. Yeah, but just chooses to be a nun or a doll because that's what's on the poster.
Speaking of the shape of the demon, I agree with Matt and what he was saying before about how the image of the nun itself is unsettling at first.
From a distance.
From a distance.
Not up close.
At first. Because there's even a shot that's included in the trailer where it's the painting of the nun that Patrick Wilson does in The Conjuring 2 or whatever, but it's in the nun trailer and cut into the nun movie. And then, like, I don't know, a light switches off, and then the painting looks alive, mm-hmm. and it's got these very creepy, like, green-yellow eyes,
yeah.
and it's sort of shrouded in shadow, and you can just barely see the nun, and it's terrifying. It's
yeah.
easily the scariest image in the trailer, in the film. However...
And it's like a little short film plugged into the middle of The Conjuring 2 that has nothing to do with anything, you know, which, again, is just them debuting this monster for later consumption.
Which is their shtick.
Yes.
But, like, pretty much every monster, demon, what have you, in the Conjuring universe and in James Wan's filmography overall, it just looks a little goofy once you get a good look at it. Like,
the Darth Maul demon from Insidious is the prime example of
yeah,
this.
Yeah, the sort of goofy, derpy-looking Darth Maul demon. And yeah, Valak, once you get up close and it's just got, like, some sharp teeth and, as Matt was talking about earlier, just starts talking English at Frenchy. It's just, this isn't spooky anymore. It's just a monster. It's like a monster in a sci-fi movie, almost. There's no...
Yeah, like a killer robot or something, where it just picks you up and throws you real good.
Yeah, so, my advice, if you were to rebuild this movie, is less of the nun close up. I don't know about less of the nun overall, because there isn't that much necessarily, but maybe a little bit. And this is where, if you weren't going to more rigidly define, at least in your own mind, what the nun is capable of, this is where you could take advantage of that, in that you could have secondary antagonists or secondary forms, but just, like, make them better. I don't know.
Less not good.
Instead of just, like, a boy vomiting snakes or black veil on a corpse or the cadre of invisible nuns wearing their habits, you know, if you pick another creature or something more tangible, kind of like we talked about in the Slender Man episode, to sort of offload some of those scares, you're probably better off. Because once we get too much of the nun, too up close, it's gone. The magic is gone. What little magic there was to begin with.
Yeah, I agree. The nun is spookiest, shrouded in mist, several meters off, drifting slowly towards you, like it's in no hurry. It's not throwing quips at you, and it's not thrashing around. It's just taking its time. That's what creeped me out more than anything. My advice, I guess, is that and the movie does milk its setting for some good atmosphere near the beginning. It fumbles it occasionally. You were complaining. We both laughed in the theater. There's a shot of them. It almost looks like it's a very sunny, pretty shot. You have to expect to see, like, Julie Andrews, like, spinning around. They're going over a little mountain trail, very scenic looking, but there's a dark cloud drifting across the shot.
And if that wasn't enough, there's also, it's not a scare chord exactly, but a very ominous dark chord of
droning.
Like, yeah, okay, we get it. They're going to the bad place.
But the shot is so ineptly composed that the cloud isn't even all-encompassing. It looks like it's just passing overhead, but in the, like, top right corner of the frame, you can see that there's more sunlight. You know, it looks like they're passing under a cloud and then they'll be fine again. Like, that's the visual language of that shot. So the idea that oh no, they're being swallowed by darkness is just totally missed the mark. But for the most part, that Abbey is a scary place, and I don't think that there's that many scarier locations available to you as a filmmaker than a haunted abbey in a remote area in rural Romania.
You know, there's haunted abbeys, there's abandoned mental hospitals.
Right.
You know, it's like there's only a couple of things that are on that tier of just automatically like base level creepy without you having to lift a finger.
Exactly. And that's when this movie works best, is before they start lifting that finger. And the question of, all right, that's good. What comes next? And there isn't really a good answer to that question in this case. But the foundation is there. I wouldn't change any of that. So in that respect, The Nun is much better off than Slender Man. Most movies are. The fact that it's a cloistered abbey and the nuns are, even by nun standards, extremely solitary creatures. They, you know, will only interact with Sister Irene. And even with her, they're very standoffish because she hasn't taken her vows yet. She's a novitiate. So there's a lot of mysticism, a lot of secrets, a lot of hushed voices when you're seeing the nuns on screen. There's a lot of shots of furtive nuns just poking their heads through barred windows and then disappearing around the corner. All of that is pretty eerie. It's made less so, I think, by the revelation that none of that was really happening, that it was all just her visions.
No, I completely agree. I think it would have been more effective if the nuns... I mean, it's hard to square with the fact that the movie begins with the last two nuns, and one of them has to commit suicide, and the other one's killed by the demon. But if they could have figured out a way to square that, I think the movie would have worked better if the nuns had actually been there. And then, you know, maybe they all die. That's fine. But it also would have helped to give this movie a body count, which it does not have. I mean, I guess all the nuns do die, but you don't see that. That's not part
of it. And then Frenchie becomes possessed years later.
Right.
For the sake of tying it in with a movie that I only half remember from 2013.
Yeah, but only the...
Stupid.
Yeah, there are only two people that die in this entire movie, and they're both at the beginning.
They're both in the prologue. And one dies by her own hand.
Yeah, and I'm not...
Barely even counts.
Right.
If you're a gore hound.
Right, and I'm not, really.
No.
But it's just, in a horror movie, almost always, you need to have some kind of body count to, you know, have there be real stakes. And that's one of the biggest issues with the Conjuring universe in general and James Wan's films, is that they're just so timid. They spoiler alert for the end of the first Conjuring film, the mother of the family, she has been possessed by whatever's haunting the house, and she is about to kill one of her own children. And I'm not saying, like, fucking kill all the children, have her kill all of them, but just the movie goes there and it's extracting the impact of that decision, but then it doesn't follow through.
It goes all soft and gooey.
Yeah, she gets exorcised at the last possible second and the kid doesn't die. And yeah, it's the same problem in this movie. Just nobody dies.
People consistently emerge. It's not even just a question of do they live or die. They typically emerge from these movies pretty much unscathed. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically. There's not really any indication that these things are going to... The last scene is always brightly lit and they're like joking and bantering.
Yeah.
Almost without exception. I think that the second Annabelle ends on a slightly more grim note, but I really don't remember. That's just kind of the taste it left in my mouth.
Right. But so anyway, if the nuns had been alive during the course of the movie's events, and then they had all been killed during the confrontation, the Saving Private Ryan moment, as Matt put it, or thereabouts, that could have given the movie a little bit more heft and impact, as opposed to, those nuns weren't here, it was all a dream.
I think, yeah, having the nuns all dead before they arrive is a huge missed opportunity. I would have taken it in a different direction, which is that this idea that it's an abbey built on an evil site, and I mean like innately evil, like, you know, the old baron or whoever was doing all kinds of satanic shenanigans. There's a literal hell mouth underneath this church. It's a sacred site that is just kind of flimsily papered over a satanic site. And that tension is really interesting. So I feel like if you show up, if you have three outsiders show up to this church where this spiritual battle has been waging for centuries, all of these nuns who don't speak most hours of the day, who don't interact with anyone but each other, who are deep, deep in this monastery life, this kind of hermetic seclusion. That's just, it's so fucking spooky. It writes itself, you know? Like the idea that, it, almost in that kind of hackneyed, like lunatics have taken over the asylum kind of feeling. Like you show up and the nuns just seem not quite right because they're a little cracked in the head because they've been dealing with this demonic influence for so long and you don't know how far they've succumbed.
Yeah.
You know, and then...
And like different nuns could appear to have succumbed to different extents.
Right.
And then it could turn out that the one you thought was the craziest was actually the most sane and the most on your side. There's so many directions you could go with this.
Yeah. Well, I just feel like the one of the craziest horror movies never filmed happened right before the nun starts. With like the last two victims, you know, one falls prey to Valak and then the other one hangs herself. What happened to the other 100 or 200? You know, that must have been a fucking bloodbath. I mean, I'm imagining something out of like Ken Russell's The Devils. You know, just get as crazy as you want with it. I would have loved to see that. I love this idea of them going off these three outsiders coming into this place and just getting in way over their heads. And, you know, narratively, that is what happens. But
they don't make the most of it. Not by a long shot. Another thing that I would have done, and I feel a little bit bad because I don't think Thaisa Farmiga should necessarily have her career governed by her relation to a more famous actress in her older sister. But that being said, and this didn't dawn on me prior to the movie, which I thought was weird because I make these sorts of connections all the time, but it dawned on me like almost immediately after we first see her on screen in The Nun. I like, literally leaned over to Matt and like, oh, so wait, so... So yeah, that's going to be the younger version of Vera Farmiga's character, right? And Matt, you know, you kind of looked at me and nodded like you more or less bought it.
Non-committal, but yeah, I wasn't sure what they were going to do. I thought she'd be related somehow.
Right. And at that point, I was thinking all throughout, yeah, I bet their big twist is going to be that was Lorraine Warren all along. Because, yeah, okay, her name is Sister Irene, but sometimes nuns, you know, they take different names for the purposes of being nuns than their given names. So maybe once she decided to give up being a nun, her given name was actually Lorraine. I don't know.
It makes as much sense as a French-Canadian melon farmer finding himself in Romania in the 1950s just so that he can participate in this movie.
Right.
You know, it's going to be ridiculous no matter what, but the franchise is not above that.
No.
At all.
So I figured that was going to be the big twist, and I thought to myself, it'll actually be a much bigger surprise if it's not her. As it turns out, yeah, they are completely unrelated. It's purely a coincidence that Thaisa Farmiga plays Sister Irene, and then Vera Farmiga plays Lorraine Warren.
And they both have dealings with this same demonic nun entity several decades apart.
And both have dealings with Frenchie.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise, but to no effect, like, whatsoever. And thinking about it afterwards, it occurred to me that preying upon this certitude in my head that they were going to be one and the same character in the end, if... Again, this movie had the stones to do this sort of thing. If they had killed Sister Irene, like in the course of the battle with Valak, that would have been a huge shock to me.
I mean, again, it's a shock. It would be a shock if anyone died in any of these movies, but doubly so if it's a character that you think they're setting up for future installments.
Right. Now, I don't know if this would have the same kind of impact for somebody else who just doesn't know the names of thousands of actors and pays attention to this sort of thing. But then again,
they look very much alike.
They look very much alike.
And Vera Farmiga is in this movie also, right. in you know, stock or archival footage from right. the Conjuring movies.
And yeah, they look very similar to the point where the younger Farmiga played her sister's younger self in a film some years ago. So this would have been the second time. And yeah, I don't know. I just think that would have been a good thing that they could have taken advantage of. But the one other big change that I want to suggest is, as we've said, the final confrontation is very rote. It's just, again, some demon wrestling
mm-hmm.
that James Wan is all about for no discernible reason. And instead of that being the big climactic confrontation, what could have happened instead was that Sister Irene has been possessed by Valak, and Frenchie does not have the blood bauble. You know, it's cast off somewhere, like Irene had it, and now it's been thrown off somewhere where they can't reach it right
yeah,
away.
Or maybe it doesn't work as well as they were led to believe it would.
Yeah, whatever the case may be. Point being, throwing blood on her doesn't work, and then Father Burke is forced to conduct an exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of this is just because I have a huge weakness for exorcisms, exorcism movies. We watched The Devil Inside.
And we've seen a lot of them.
Yeah, we watched The Devil Inside knowing that it was apparently just a completely awful film, just because I'm like, well, it's about, you know, rogue exorcists. Like, that sounds pretty cool. How bad could it really be? Mm-hmm. Turns out, absolutely atrocious, but we don't need to get into that. Point being, I have a thing for exorcisms, so this is coming partially out of that. But still, I think Father Burke, you know, he's haunted by this failed exorcism of this young boy in France, and if he has to save this young nun using the same methods and the same tools, but, like, you know, hopefully he doesn't fucking hurt her so bad she dies this time, it very much brings it full circle.
Yes, and it gives his character an arc, which he otherwise doesn't have.
Yeah.
Because, no. as I already mentioned, his demon, the snake boy, just dematerializes when Valak gets sealed in the Hellmouth. His trauma is just making a cameo appearance in a different story that has very little to do with him. He doesn't have closure at all. What Jim's suggesting is the obvious conclusion. I can't believe that they didn't do it that way.
Yeah, no. And you could have that end any way you want. I mean, I think in order to, again, bring it full circle, you know, Irene would have to survive, and theoretically you would have to banish Valak, but maybe Father Burke doesn't survive the exorcism and he dies having brought peace to his conscience. Yeah. Or maybe he lives. It doesn't really matter. That's, you know, dealer's choice. But you would have given him an arc. You would have given the confrontation some thematic heft.
A little bit of dramatic weight, yeah.
And instead, it's just some fighting a demon, you know, hand to hand.
Yeah, and Burke gets bit on the eye by a snake.
By a snake. So, but yeah, I mean, in the end, the nun is more or less harmless.
Yeah, it's perfectly passable. I like it more than any of the Insidious sequels, I think. Or I enjoyed it more while I was watching it. I'm already, like, I've had to consult my phone a few times to remember the characters' names. Like, it's not going to stick around up here, up top. But it's not a waste of time.
But it is definitely a wasted opportunity on so many levels.
Yeah, you know? And I wish it just had been its own beast a little bit more. It could have stood to distance itself from the Conjuring franchise even further, because it's already set in Romania in the 1950s. That's as far away as you can get without setting it in the actual Middle Ages or, like, on the moon. You know? Like, what's it gonna fucking take? I just hate this feeling of, like, herding cats, you know, trying to rope all these movies into one big happy family. It's nonsense. Let it be its own thing.
Well, anyway, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I am still Matt Gerandasi, much to my chagrin.
And we will see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Before we go, I'd like to make some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Nun official teaser trailer uploaded by Warner Brothers Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode, discussing the new slasher flick, Hellfest, will be up on Sunday, October 14th. See you then.